In our next program, we're going to look at what's going on in the forest fiber industry. Raw materials is always an issue. It's involved in a lot of economic issues as well as supply. We have today to speak to this topic Henry Spelter from Forest Economic Advisors. Henry's a partner with FEA, responsible for bioenergy and wood product analysis. He's the lead analyst for FEA's Wood Biomass Forest Services publications, and he also authors FEA's Lumber Markets Status and Trends monthly publication. His career spans 30 years in the forest products industry, starting at a laboratory in Madison, Wisconsin, where he was responsible for analysis of timber and panel industries. And he's moved on through, more recently, he's co-authored the report entitled North America's Wood Pellet Sector. This is an area where obviously we compete head to head with a lot of other suppliers, which of course was part of the BCAP issue that came up last year. We're very familiar with some of the dynamics in the byproducts market, the wood pellet, the forest industry allocations between the wood fiber users, but understanding how that relationship is changing on a regular basis, on a current basis, is one of the things that we want to look at because it does affect our future. For 6 years, he authored a continuing series of monthly commentaries on wood byproducts markets. He began his career as a forestry assistant right here in Cook County. He got his, he spent 4 years consulting for Data Resources, Inc. in Lexington, Massachusetts, and he's the manager of the Forest Products Forsim service. So he's very experienced exactly in the areas that we're interested in, and we welcome you to the podium, Henry Spelter.
Thank you, Bob. Welcome all to Chicago. Willkommen nach Chicago, bienvenue à Chicago. I hope I covered all the bases. I know the acoustics here are not the best, so I will try and project, but if I'm also battling a bit of a hoarseness, so please bear with me. I'll do the best that I can. A few words about us. We are basically a bunch of economists with a forestry background and a forestry interest. Most of us have worked in the forest industry for the last 15 or so years. We are engaged solely in analyzing the economics of the solid wood products industry and focus most of our attention on that area there. These are the gentlemen who are involved currently in our present group, Forest Economic Advisors. The gentleman on the top there is the analyst for lumber. The one below him is the macroeconomic analyst. The gentleman down here was supposed to have been here today. He's our timber specialist, but he was called off elsewhere. I'm down there wearing the Chicago Foresters uniform. At the present, we don't have anybody looking at mulch and soils, but based on the attendance over here, maybe we should start one. But so this is basically the background for Forest Economic Advisors. So as you might imagine, given our interest, a lot of our focus is on the economics of housing and the economy in general, but primarily on housing. And so I'm going to devote the first part of my talk about our outlook for the housing market and what that implies for forest products. Most economists start out with what has happened in the past and take our cue from there. We looked at past housing cycles, housing recessions, and basically analyzed the last four recessions that we've had, and came up with this sort of a pattern that occurred normally in the post-war period, a fairly sharp downturn followed by an even sharper recovery once the economic stress induced by the Federal Reserve has been relaxed and housing started coming up again. So that was our basic framework for looking at this particular cycle. And if everything had gone according to normal, we'd be at 652,000 housing starts in 2010 and 744,000 single-family houses in 2011. What actually happened, though, is the following. For about 9 months or so, we looked great. And then we began to deviate from the normal pattern, and a totally different pattern took shape. Instead of a U-shaped recovery or a V-shaped recovery, which many of us had been thinking about, instead we got more or less an L. And that's where we're currently stuck at. So what is different this time as compared to the normal cycles that we've experienced in the past? First off, this is a recession that was not caused or engineered by the Federal Reserve tightening. Rather, it was something that was caused by a more fundamental balance sheet recession, a disconnect between assets, what you own, and what you earn. We had too much debt, too few assets to cover it. We had too much malinvestment, chiefly in real estate. And as a consequence of the losses that have been incurred there, banks have become extremely cautious and conservative, and that is all holding us back and preventing us from having a normal recovery, but rather a recovery marked by very slow growth and very slow recovery in employment. Too much debt. This indicates how much debt there is relative to disposable income. And you notice that we like to stay at one in that ratio overall. We went way above it in this last pre-2008 boom period. We are now beginning to deleverage that. This is the consumer aspect of it, trying to deleverage. The previous speaker had spoken about how much the consumer sector has been paying back down their debts. This is one of the reasons holding back our current recovery. We also have too few assets. Income growth has been very anemic. In fact, in nominal terms, bottom line down there shows that we've actually declined for the first time 2 years in a row in the past 2 years. And when we look at it in real terms, when we factor out the inflation that has taken place, the 3.9% inflation that we've had this year, for example, we're down significantly in terms of the purchasing power of the average median household income. So too much debt relative to too little assets. We had a too much malinvestment in real estate. This particular chart shows the amount of vacant homes in the system relative to the normal population of homes. There's normally going to be a certain number of homes that are always vacant because of people moving or because of second homes that are not being utilized. That ratio is given by that flat line over there. And as you can see in the 2004, 2005, 2007 period, we went way above that. That was the boom. We were predicting a sort of a slow recovery back to a more normal level in about 4 or 5 years back in 2009. And as you can see, since then, the 2 years that have elapsed, we've made very little progress in bringing back that level of vacancies down to a more normal level. So this is one of the things that are holding back our housing. Now, you could argue that maybe that vacant unit flatline that was based on the historical average is maybe too conservative. Maybe there's an upward trend as we become more wealthy. We can afford to have more houses sitting vacant. But on the other hand, even if you do have a slight upward trend, we're still way above where we should be in terms of what is a normal level of vacant inventories that have to be disposed of and absorbed in the system. So we're still in that getting back to that normal level range, whether it's all the way back to the bottom line or to some upward trending line, we're still above that. We have about 24% of homes that are currently underwater. Between 2008 and 2004, we've had roughly 36 million transactions take place. And based on recent prices, those properties are all underwater. They're worth less than what they were paid for originally. Since 2008, we had 4.4 million foreclosures. That leaves about 32 million left still underwater out of a total population of 131 million units. So we got about a 24% rate of homes that are worth less today than what they were when they were purchased. This is another drag both on economic growth as well as the housing market in particular. So we're having a property here that is showing the level of distress in the property market and the real estate market. Both the delinquency rate and the long-term delinquency rate are still extended. They have begun to come down. We're beginning to see the worst of the foreclosure and the liquidity crisis behind us. But we are still at very high accelerated levels and still need to see that come down more to the 5 to 6% range. That is normal of a healthy housing market. The one good thing to take away from this chart is that our, I can barely see this, but this 90-day serious delinquency rate, there's been a lot of talk about the number of homes that are being held off the market by the banks because they do not want to flood the market. If that were the case, that red line would still be high and probably even rising. But the fact that it's coming down shows to me and shows to us that the backlog is not as serious as has been feared. So this is one good element from this, but there's still a long ways to go before we can say that we're back to a normal market. So this results in excessive conservatism on some part of the financial system. There's a lot of losses, a lot of lawsuits involved from the previous boom and a bust. This is all the money that has been put into the system by the Federal Reserve since the crash. This is $1.6 trillion worth of potential liquidity. This is like a spring-loaded force with a potential to grow the economy. But it's sitting idle, basically, at the Federal Reserve. It went right back to them earning next to nothing because the banks are at this point not in a position, either because of lack of demand or because of lack of conservatism or more difficult lending environment, to put that money to work. So we have a lot of money potentially on the sidelines waiting to be put to use, but currently it's sitting idle, another contributing factor to the slow growth. So that results in slow growth in employment. The red flat line shows the number of new entrants into the labor force on a monthly basis. About 150,000 people joined the adult civilian labor force. So just to keep pace with that, we need 150,000 new jobs. And since the recovery has started, we've been basically just holding steady at that level. We haven't gained ground on the losses that we've taken in the recession leading up to that. So as a consequence, the employment rate is basically flat. And we focus on the employment rate because logically as well as economically, it's a very important determinant of the ability of people to form households and therefore go into the home market, home purchasing market. Employment rate is basically flat, and that's a significant indicator of household formations. Einstein had E equals mc squared. This is my contribution to the economic knowledge. This is the Hedge-Shapiro equation, which basically says that it's a function of the current year's employment rate and the lagged previous year's employment rate. It shows a very good correlation between the actual and what this equation would give you. And the important thing to note here is that how much the Hedge-Shapiro rate, that is the number of people per population who have been able to break off into households, how much that has increased over the past four decades, and how much it has fallen since then. Bear in mind that there's about 240 million of us in the adult civilian population. So a 1% decline in that blue line leads to a 2.4 million hole in the demand for housing units. That's a very important number. It's part of the basic equation that determines how much the demand for housing is going to be. And currently, we are in a negative position for that because of the lack of ability of people to find jobs and jobs that pay enough money to be able to allow them to form, separate their own households. There is a bullish case to be made for housing and housing demand based on demographics, which consists of two things. The lower end of it here is the natural growth in the adult population, and then the upper end, red portion is the immigration coming into the country. And that is happening at a rate of about 3 million per year, year in and year out. So if we apply the 0.5% Hedge-Shapiro rate to this 3 million people coming in, that means that 1.5 million supposedly should be the basic level of new demand for housing based on demographic growth alone. Now again, we have to factor in the fact that the Hedge-Shapiro rates are declining. As I mentioned, 2.4 million is worth the potential loss for 1% decline in the Hedge-Shapiro rate. But this is the bullish case. We're still having population growth and demographics indicating potential greater demand for housing if the wherewithal is there for people to be able to form their own separate households. This is also encouraging because it's 2 years since we put this chart together. Immigration has continued to hold up at that 1 million plus per year rate. Illegal immigration has been mentioned before, has basically stopped, at least from Mexico. It has gone to very low levels as compared to before. But the important element here is the legal immigration, because those are the folks who are more likely to quickly join a housing demand equation, whereas the illegal immigration tends to be much more condensed in their housing needs, so they're not as big of a factor. Home prices relative to median income have also corrected since the bubble has burst. We've had about a 30-35% drop in prices of homes. Although income has stagnated, that drop in prices brought it closer to the point where it's realistically affordable by more people. And it would have even fallen some more had, of course, the Federal Reserve not reduced interest rates to the extent that it has. The low interest rates are basically supporting housing prices at a level that is still historically elevated relative to incomes, but is still at an affordable level when you factor in the lower financing rates. So here we come to our housing forecast, and Mr. Perry's comment about economists being, what did he say, we're bipolar. This is certainly true for us here, because we've been burned in terms of our housing forecast by just this stubborn lack of the ability of the economy to grow. And the question is this going to continue some more? Are all these headwinds holding back housing, the higher loan requirements, the higher qualification requirements, the lower household separation rates, are all of these sufficient to offset the potential increases that we should be seeing from demographics? And so basically what we've done here is we've split the difference. We basically said that one more year we will have another poor year of housing starts, that's 2012, and then slowly see a sort of a U-shaped recovery culminating in about 1.6 million units by 2015. So that is our basic forecast right now. Again, overwhelming, based on the assumption that demographics at some point has to kick in, with one caveat, and that is that the share of these homes might now begin to share predominantly towards multifamily rental homes as opposed to single-family standalone homes. And the importance of that for forest products and for all the ramifications that come from that is that a multifamily uses only about a quarter to a third of the amount of lumber, plywood, panels that a single family uses. So while the total number is going up, probably the mixture is going to favor less wood-intensive aspects of it. So the housing summary is that the 2008 business cycle was not normal. We have to take into account the fact that there are different circumstances of work and the dynamic that are holding it back and making it a more stretched out recovery than the normal. The demographics look good, but we still need income and job growth to make that a realistically realizable gain in housing demand. Employment needs to increase at wages commensurate with living standards for people to be able to afford a housing, and there are some certain questions about that. And so the risks to the housing rebound is that household formation is delayed by the lack of job growth, by the lack of good-paying jobs, and that prevents people from separating to the degree that the demographics would suggest. And so consequently, we have this delayed, slower recovery than what we would have seen normally. So total North American lumber demand, this includes both Canada and the United States, recovery is going to continue a little bit slower than what we thought 2 years ago, but we are still coming back. Not nowhere near the level which was experienced in 2005, 2006, at the period of the boom. Still not quite normal yet, still in excess of the capacity that we have for in making lumber, but it is coming back to a certain extent and expected to continue. Here's the conversion of plywood and particle board. Again, a slow, gradual recovery, not nearly to the same level as before, but coming back and helping to recover the forest products industry. So what does this mean for residues? These are the factors that we use to convert a given amount of lumber, plywood, OSB to given various types of residue streams. In 2010, we had about 60 million oven-dry tons of residues generated, mostly from two areas of fines and bark. Fines would be things like sawdust and shavings. Fines, of course, and then bark would be bark. Most of it comes from the lumber sector. A small portion of it comes from OSB and plywood in terms of fines. Secondary producers like millwork and furniture factories are another source. And then we have And that's it for fines. And then for bark, we have additional amounts of residues coming from the pulp sector. But of course, a lot of that is used by themselves for their own internal needs. Here it is just for the North America as a whole. This is, again, converting the lumber demand into so many units of bark. And this is the amount of fines, sawdust, and shavings, 77% of the 2005 peak by 2013. So that's our basic outlook for residue generation. This is only part of the story. So let's go on to the second part, which is an examination of the biomass, which is a new element in this whole thing. What I have here is a chart that was basically started by a gentleman named Charles Keeling. There he is, if I can figure out where this pointer is. He took measurements at the top of Mount Mauna Loa up in Hawaii on the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And he did this over several decades and found a strong, consistent upward trend in the amount of carbon dioxide that he found in the atmosphere. And that's represented here by the vertical line, which in this 415,000-year scale becomes just a vertical line. Other people went back and tried to replicate his numbers in terms of history from ice core samples in the Antarctic. And they came up with this kind of a greenish fluctuation of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And they were able to correlate that with changes in the temperature. I've broken this into a line around 240 parts per million, which roughly corresponds to the break-even between glacial and interglacial periods. When there's a lot of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, they found that the temperatures were warm. When there was less carbon dioxide, they found the temperatures were on the cold side. So whether or not this is cause or effect, I'm not qualified to say, but I can say that if this is cause, then I think our future generations will look back on us with gratitude for having short-circuited the next ice age, by and large, by raising carbon dioxide levels to the levels that we're currently at. So this is the scientific basis for a lot of policy decisions that have been made. In the U.S., we have certain policy objectives put in by the current administration to have 17% of greenhouse gas emissions reduced by 2020, to by 2050, 83% reduction, and by 2035, generate 80% of electricity from so-called clean energy. Over in Europe, they have a very strong mandate to reduce gross energy consumption, to obtain gross energy consumption of 20% of it from renewable sources by 2020. And to put that into context, only 8.4% of it came from these sources in 2008. So they've got basically a doubling in the next decade ahead of them. These are the basic policy drivers that drive everything else that we're seeing in the bioenergy field. So there are three basic ways in which we can meet these standards and goals that have been put in place. We can get them through electricity. We can get them through electricity generation. We can do it through heating of space, and then transportation. I'm going to ignore transportation because it is very hypothetical at this point. Nothing has really been proven to be economical. Despite all the efforts at making it go, it is still basically a project for the future. Most of the biomass that is being used today is being used to fire electricity plants, power plants, or to use heating space. These are some of the incentives that are currently in place. Most of these are set to expire in 2012 or 2013. We have a credit of 2.2 cents per kilowatt hour for wind. Most of the others get 1.1 cent per kilowatt hour. We have two biomass options here. One is closed loop, which is irrelevant because nobody is making closed loop biomass. That is where you have a plantation specifically done only to produce biomass for a power plant. We don't have any of those. Most of those are purchased in the open market. They only get 1.1 cent per kilowatt hour of government subsidy. Other production incentives in place are, of course, you've got the production investment tax credit. You have a production tax credit, which you can take in lieu of the the production credit, 30% of the cost for installation of capital for solar equipment set to expire in 2016. And then we have various loan guarantee programs, Solyndra, Evergreen, Range Fuels. Those are examples. And those of you who haven't been following developments in this field, I put that there with a certain amount of irony because they've all failed. So there has been a lot of money invested in these, but the return on those has not been very good. But these are some of the things that are driving the growth of electricity and other types of biomass using materials. This chart is important because it shows you where these things stand on their own in terms of their economics. If you look at nothing else but the pure economics without any government incentives, you find that gas and coal are by far the most economical to use. Because of the scale involved here, because combined solar power and photovoltaic, those are very expensive. They raise the scale to a very high level. So it appears that these other alternatives here are pretty close, but in fact, they're still quite negative in terms of comparison with coal and gas. But note here, if you take coal, and if you impose on coal the requirement that they capture and sequester carbon, the additional cost of that procedure, of that process, then raises that cost above these other alternatives, wind, geothermal, and biomass. So if we had in place a national portfolio standard or a cap and trade system or something along those lines that would require the policy to be based around reducing carbon dioxide emissions, then biomass, geothermal, and wind would become actually quite competitive. However, in the absence of that, what's driving, well, let's just summarize what we've got over here. We've got basically three variables that we have to look at in terms of the competitiveness of each of these products, approaches to making energy. One is the cost, which goes over here. Whether or not they're baseload capable, some of them are, some of them are not. Wind, of course, is not. Photovoltaic is not, but other versions of it are. And then how much in land use is taken up in terms of these, and some of them are very high, and others, such as gas, are very low. So what's driving the biomass market currently is, therefore, not a national portfolio standard, but rather state standards that exist in about 31 different states, ranging anywhere from Pennsylvania of about 8% energy by 2020 to Maine up to 40%. California is 30% by 2020. So these are fairly significant. Most of them are in a 15 to 20% range. And these are fixed mandates that require utilities within those states to generate a certain proportion of their electricity from these green renewable energy resources, such as wind, photovoltaic, combined solar power, or biomass. And if we take those mandates and multiply those mandates by the projected amount of electricity demanded as the economy grows, we get this line over here, which indicates the implied level of kilowatt hours that will have to be generated from biomass. The bottom portion shows the projections from the annual energy outlook from 2011. And the reason they don't follow the upward trend of the state renewable portfolio standards is because they take at face value the phasing out of the incentives that are going into effect in 2012 to 2016. I personally don't think that they will be phased out, that at some point they will be reinstituted in one form or another, and that the most likely path for them to follow will still be the state renewable portfolio standard. But even under the slow growth scenario, biomass basically doubles between now and 2020. That means the amount of fiber used to generate electricity doubles by 2020. So the second alternative is heating using pellets, which is wood fiber compacted into a small compact shape and used as a heat substitute for coal, for example. It's a relatively easy product to substitute in an existing coal-fired power plant up to a certain percentage because it handles pretty much like coal and can be used in its place to a certain degree. Wood pellets date back to about 1973, the first energy crisis, when a number of entrepreneurs in the West Coast began making wood pellets from sawmill residues. And domestically, we basically use it as an auxiliary source of heat. That is, we use it as a space heater rather than as a general all-purpose heater for the house as a whole. And currently, the main growth comes from exports from the aforementioned mandates put in place by the European Union to replace 20% of their energy by renewable resources by 2020. This is the indicator of how domestic demand is growing. It's the amount of pellet appliance shipments that take place in the United States every year. And except for periods when you have energy price hikes, if you watch closely the price of heating oil, that is usually an indicator when this goes up. But aside from those periods, it's pretty moderate growth. It's a sort of a linear type growth in terms of overall demand. And this is being met currently by the initial producers of pellets who came in around 2007, 2008, when the first demand spurt took place, relatively small, localized producers of pellet fuels getting residue material from sawmills, from plywood plants, from furniture factories, and so forth, using raw residue from those primary processors to make the pellets. Those are the ones who are supplying this sort of linear growing demand domestically. The big growth is coming from Europe because there simply is not enough residue and fiber available in Europe to meet their domestic goals. So their basic alternative is to source it either from North America, to a certain extent from Russia, and to a very limited extent from Latin America. But primarily North America is the first choice, and in fact the U.S. South is becoming the zero center point for the growth of the pellet business. And this second wave of pellet plants are coming in, but fortunately from your point of view, they're coming in at a scale that cannot be supported by residues. So they have to go out and compete in the pulp market for pulpwood-based material to supply the kind of volumes that the European demand market demands. The projection is for at least, a 2.5-fold increase based on the 20% increase in their proportion of electricity from renewable plus an increase in the market share of biomass. There are several countries, England, Great Britain in particular, where coal-fired power plants are being phased out by 2015. There's been a lot of investment in those plants, some of them still have plenty of life left in them, and the operators are trying to maintain their life by using, in place of coal, pellets sourced from North America to replace the fuel that fires those plants. So that is basically behind this fairly strong, substantial growth in pellet demand coming to Europe from North America. So putting that same curve into the context of North American pellet capacity, you can see we've had a tremendous growth. It's almost an exponential type growth. The domestic market kind of stuttered after the oil price and the gas prices went down. However, as I said, the European export demand is sustaining the growth and continuing to accelerate the growth of the pellet sector. And almost hardly a month goes by without a new announcement of some new plant coming in or some new investor coming in, mainly in the U.S. South, to a certain extent in interior British Columbia, putting in new plants of a scale to satisfy the needs of the European market. Usually these plants are located within 80 to 50 miles of the coast so that they have easy access to port facilities to be able to transship them over to Europe, mostly to Holland and Belgium. So let's put together supply and demand for sawdust and shavings. The supply, again, is derived from our projections of lumber, plywood, OSB. And the trading demand, or what I call the traditional demand, is coming from our projections of particle board and medium density fiber board. And that shows a relatively stable relationship between those two. If that were the only source of demand for wood residues, then it would be more or less business as usual. But when we superimpose the demand for wood sawmill residues from the pellet sector, we now get a total change in the balance between supply and demand. There's this whole new element coming in that is going to be competing for this limited sawmill residue that's available from sawmills, plywood mills, and so forth. Now, one ameliorating factor is that most of that increase is taking place in British Columbia, where there was a lot of excess waste residue that was just burnt and not used for anything. So it's not really coming in and impacting the more traditional eastern seaboard market for these kinds of materials. But in places like New England, the South, eastern Canada, this is going to become a serious source of extra demand for sawmill residues and other byproducts from wood processing plants. So overall woody biomass demand by sector is shown in this particular slide. As I noted, we discount much of an impact from liquid biofuels. It's too difficult to see that becoming much of a factor over the next 5 years. Wood pellets are going to be increasing. The electric power sector is also going to be increasing because of the state renewable portfolio standards. The non-structural panels are growing very little because of the slower economic recovery. And the forest products industry itself will continue to use most of this residue for their own internal power and steam electricity needs. So with mill residue remaining constrained, a growing share will have to come of the fiber will have to come from the forests themselves. As you can see here, mill residues are still the main source of supply, but logging residues are now becoming increasingly important. And then roundwood itself is now becoming a more important factor in the overall supply to meet these particular needs. This final chart here, I'm showing here the trend that we expect in pulpwood prices, which is sort of similar to the residue price as well. We expect to see a moderate amount of increase as, on the one hand, the pulp sector does not come back as strong as it has historically due to its internal problems of demand. But as the economy recovers and as more of these pellet plants come in place, the demand for pulpwood will drive the prices up, but only in a relatively stable range in terms of both the north, east, and the south for hardwood and for softwood. So the take-home points, I think, from all of this is that we're going to have a very slow, by historical standard, recovery in housing. It will not be as sharp as we had expected based on previous patterns. It will be a more dragged out, slower for all the headwinds that are holding housing back. And as a consequence, biomass supply will not be as growing as fast as it would have otherwise. Biomass for energy use is going to grow because of the state renewable portfolio standards, offshore demand for European mandates. But they will mostly impact forest residues rather than, and forest pulpwood as well, rather than sawmill residues. Pellet demand is the fastest growing biomass segment due to the European renewable energy goals. And finally, the demand for fiber for export-oriented pellet mills will come from roundwood. Demand for mill waste residues will grow and lead to somewhat tighter supply relative to what it would have been otherwise in the absence of the growing pellet sector. So I think that summarizes our current view on where forest products are headed and where forest biomass plays a role in the next couple of years. If you have any questions, I'd be certainly glad to entertain them.
Ship it somewhere. the total amount of pollution that is used through the process of making the pellets, the fact that, you know, coal is used to make the electricity to make the pellets, and you add all that together and then you burn the pellets, is it still cleaner to do that if you consider the entire pollution situation that you have in making the pellets and then growing the pellets and the difference in pollution when you burn the pellets versus fuel, considering the fact that you make all this pollution when you make the pellets? What's the answer to that?
The answer is, I think, twofold. If you're talking about pellets made from wood residue in a sawmill, for example, that would otherwise be burnt in a wigwam burner in any event, then there is a net gain there.
Okay, but that's not what I mean.
Yeah, but if you're talking about the whole tree, yeah.
Taking the whole tree, converting it into sawdust, and I've been to some of these plants that make a lot of pellets, and they're consuming a tremendous amount of energy.
Absolutely.
And that electricity is coming from a power plant that's burning coal. Okay, so you add it all together, are we making more pollution by making pellets and then burning them versus just burning coal?
Well, I haven't run the numbers, but my off-the-cuff guess would be that we're adding more pollution than we're saving.
So you would think that somebody intelligent would look at this whole thing and say, hey, you know what? This is really worse for the environment.
And they're beginning to come to that conclusion. I mean, even in England, the amount of opposition to the conversion of these 1,000 megawatt coal-fired power plants to biomass, to pellet, basically.
I asked this question to the people that are in the pellet business. They're like, oh, shush, oh, don't talk about that. We don't want to go there.
Yeah, and for good reason.
And they're answering me by not answering my question.
Well, absolutely, absolutely. This is totally driven by government mandates, supposedly aimed at reducing carbon dioxide.
Are they driven by special interests that have them do this, or why would they pass a law to control pollution by requiring something that ultimately causes more pollution? Is it just stupidity on the government? Or, I mean, it seems like a no-brainer to me. I mean, I figured it out. Why? With all these studies and everything everybody did, they didn't look at the whole cycle. Not to mention the energy that went into growing the trees and fertilizing the trees and transporting the trees to the mill and the diesel fuel that was consumed transporting the trees to the mill. I mean, you add it all together and it looks to me like it's causing a lot more pollution, and I think it is. And I just, it behooves me that on top of that, the government subsidizes it and does everything else, and it's going to require us to destroy our forests so that we can have more pollution.
I completely agree with you, and I think at this point,
and then send it overseas.
And then
and put it on a boat that's consuming, burning.
Look, I don't think this is going to go all the way to the 20%, because even now the realization is, once they begin to see how much volumes are involved here, how much amount of wood is required to fuel a 1,000 megawatt power plant, it physically becomes really impossible. And at that point, some of these mandates are going to be either redirected or eased. But that may not happen until about 2015 or thereabouts. It's positive, but remember, this is not driven by savings. This is driven by the drive to maintain plants.
Right. Say it's cheaper to do the wood or cheaper to do the coal?
It's cheaper to do the coal. Are you talking about carbon capture and sequestration or just coal as is? Current. It's no question about it, coal is cheaper. And to talk about some of the bizarreness of the situation, you've got Germany, which is very concerned about all of this carbon amount in the atmosphere, and yet they're phasing out their nuclear non-carbon polluting plants by 2021. That's 20% of their electricity is coming from that source. What are they replacing it with? the dirtiest of the coal there is, which is lignite. They're going to dig up whole parts of Germany to make up the difference to fuel power plants burning lignite, which emits even more carbon dioxide. And the idea being that at some point they will come up with some technology to sequester and capture and sequester the carbon, which is all based on just hope over experience. So part of that, of course, is supposed to be coming from pellets imported from North America. But again, as I said, when the volumes that are involved are going to hit the realization of the body politic there, they're going to have to break this acceleration in demand. Otherwise, it just won't work. But for the time being, it's being driven entirely by these mandates. And all that money that is being invested in these large mega pellet plants in the South are based on these long-term contracts they're signing with the local power plants, which will be passed on to the local ratepayers over there.
Henry,
Bob.
I understood that the pellet, the utilities that are burning pellet are emissions from biomass fueled burners are exempted from reporting to EPA their carbon emissions. And that was up for, it was proposed that they be incorporated into the regular emissions program, and the biomass industry fought that tooth and nail and managed to, I believe, keep themselves out of that reporting for another cycle.
For 3 years. Right.
Has anybody studied the economic benefit? I mean, is the reduction of carbon from biofuels actually economically beneficial if you monitor the emissions? I assume it's not, or they wouldn't have objected.
No, I don't think it's economically beneficial, but the carbon issue is not driven by economics, but by this fear that it has a long-term consequence on climate change. So as long as that is the determining factor, the cost becomes secondary. And it basically, the power plants are all driven by, their plans are all driven by these mandates, which then they in turn have to fulfill and pass on to their ratepayers, whatever the cost ultimately may be.
But back to Ralph's point, if they're not monitoring the emissions, or if they're not reporting the emissions, and yet they're building the whole system around this, how much are they really reducing the coal emissions by mixing with pellets, given the footprint that creating the pellets creates?
That's my point. It's really more. It's worse.
Yeah.
It is.
But they're hiding that by not reporting.
Yeah, they don't want to talk about that.
The emissions.
Well, absolutely. That's what God has given us. We've got to, that's what we work with as economists. Those are the facts.
Will the European standards?
European plants burn a combination of wood and coal to reduce the oxygen demand to make cleaner burning.
It's called how many of the European plants are burning coal with biomass? That's called co-firing. It's quite widespread in Europe. It's not very widespread here yet, but it's very widespread in Europe, and it's one way for them to try to meet these mandates that they have to face. Up to about 15% is what they're usually using. In Germany, England, then low countries, Netherlands, Belgium, and so forth. That's where
most of the plants doing that, co-firing?
I wouldn't say the most, but there are a lot that are using it, yeah. this is a process, it's a gradual process that they have to switch over.
What co-firing does is by reducing the oxygen demand, it makes the effluent from the plants cleaner.
Yeah, we understand that.
Yeah.
Is
it doesn't, it doesn't,
way,
yeah.
The part, that all the energy that's going into making the pellets offsets that more than the benefit, and the result is more pollution at a higher price.
These came out of Kyoto, of course.
But it's a mandate
for Europe,
based
yes.
on
which are going to expire
not considering that.
Soon. Year two?
Well, if they expire, the mandates, the 20% by 2020 doesn't expire.
Their commitment to it.
The commitment to it, right.
And there's a question of whether or not economically they're going to continue after their current commitment.
You mean whether they would increase it to 30% or
no, whether they'll even continue to the 20?
Well, that's always possible. We had an election in Ontario that had it gone just one vote different would have completely changed their biomass policies as well, their green energy policies, would have completely wiped them out. So this is subject to policy change, and policies can change as people realize what's involved or as the costs become prohibitive or infeasible for one reason or another. So certainly would be a game changer. But right now we're operating under those assumptions that they're going to continue at least as they say they are. Yeah.
Okay. So when the pellets are made in our country, and you had this Kyoto protocol that's kind of out there that all the countries are kind of expected to comply with, when we use our, when we burn coal to make pellets that we're not even burning, that we're sending to Europe, aren't we, by doing that and then subsidizing it on top of that, isn't that hurting our government's long-term Kyoto protocol?
We haven't signed up to the Kyoto Protocol.
Well, I know, but
it makes us, it increases our pollution contribution
our pollution, so
without the
our
offset, because the offset
so
over
there. And then we're subsidizing on top of that, like with BCAP. Yeah.
All right. Thank you much.
Thank you, Henry. If you find a supply, buy it.